Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with James Clift. James is the founder of Durable, which in its first 2 years has raised over $20 million, and he has previously founded many other businesses, including Visual CV. Welcome, James.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the show. As you were mentioning beforehand, we've crossed like indirectly paths. You know, I've seen your name and your story go by over the years of building businesses. And so now we get a high bandwidth way to get to know each other under a Q&A about some of the many things that you've learned building various businesses.
Awesome. Yeah, super stoked to get into it.
Before we start digging into those specific lessons learned, I have some specific areas that I want to kind of dig into that I know you're going to have some things to share on in terms of having built this many businesses, mindsets for doing so, you know, strategies, as well as some of the hard-won lessons, because, you know, you can't build a few businesses without breaking a couple eggs and learning from it. I wanted to give you a chance to kind of summarize the James Clift story so far, which I am sure as over the last couple of years raising funding and building a business, you've had a lot of chance to tell that story in a pretty concise way. But how do you like to kind of to summarize the origin story, so to speak?
I like to say I've been unemployed my entire career. So the last job I had was a part-time job coaching tennis when I was 16. So really just been an entrepreneur my whole life. I don't even look at it as like entrepreneurship. I've been building and owning businesses. So started off with a web design company back in high school, ran a home services business in university, HD window cleaning, still my favorite business. Just worked with my buddies outside in the summer and made some good cash. And then went back to the web design world after graduating. Very long, probably 3-year journey of shipping a bunch of different stuff. So we had a hardware product that was like a daylighting system for commercial office buildings. So super hard tech. We're like, we won 20 grand in business plan competitions. This is enough to fund the entire company for 5 years. So just like naive young kids trying to build a real business. That didn't work out. Went back to like web design consulting. That was hard. I think we were still in that mode of, hey, we're trying to build a product that scales and that works. So probably a dozen things that we launched. One of them ended up being this site called Visual CV. That's the one that worked. Basically like top 3 resume builder on the internet. So that grew very quickly. So 0 to about $1 million in revenue in the first 12 months with 3 employees. So like super profitable. Scaled that for about 8 years and then sold it in 2020. Had a brief stint building remote work software pre-COVID. So side project that actually took off pretty quickly. It was like remote work productivity. So kind of in the virtual office category. So lots of great companies signed up. It was like Netflix, BarkBox, SurveyMonkey. Never really hit breakout product market fit, but definitely real traction. Ended up selling that one. When was that? Probably 2021. And then started Durable. And Durable is basically this simple thesis and kind of the convergence of all the things that I believe. But the TLDR is it's way too hard to own a business and to start a business. And I think business is like the key to economic freedom for billions of people. So basically, how do we unlock that, right? And if you look at, I mean, labor, it's like employment or business ownership. Employment, I think, is going away with how AI is disrupting the entire economy. And that trend was already happening, right? So business ownership is growing super quickly, especially around the world, primarily very, very small companies. So like sub 10 employees, usually sub 1 or sub 2 employees. So 1-person companies. And then we just thought about how do we abstract and automate all the business parts, right? So if you have a skill, you should be able to have a successful, profitable business in a very short amount of time. So if you're really good at landscaping, personal training, consulting, why do you have to learn web design, marketing, customer success, accounting, tax, like all this other extraneous things? Is really no, there's an economic value for your skill and you should be paid for that and take the lion's share of that as opposed to your employer. So that's kind of the core thesis. How do we automate and abstract all parts of running a business so you, the individual, can just focus on what you're great at? And AI was the big unlock for that. So we kind of had that core thesis. We're trying to build with like much worse models originally. So we're early to the OpenAI train. And then kind of GPT 3.5 was the big unlock. I was like, wow, this vision's actually possible now. I think we were on the path of being kind of a bundled up business in a box with traditional SaaS, which would have been successful. But the opportunity of AI is like you can actually solve these workflows now. So you don't have to build this like kind of copycat software. You can build brand new user experiences that actually start to solve the problem for the individual. That wasn't a concise summary, but yeah, Durable has been growing super quickly. Like you mentioned, raised a bunch of cash. Team's about 20 people now. Business has scaled a lot in the past 18 months. And yeah, it's been super intense, a lot of fun, and lots of work left to do.
There's like at least five questions that spring out of that. Thinking a little bit about some of these previous businesses, so like you talked about, you already touched on this a bit, some of the lessons you learned. Like you, I also I started doing contract web design for people when I didn't know what I was doing and I was 19 or whatever like that. And you learn, you know, there's obviously the really sort of obvious ways that you fail when you like don't know not to make a fixed bid on something when you haven't seen the code yet, and like you know, those easy lessons, or they're unpleasant but they're sort of obvious. What are some of the like the harder one or subtler lessons that you sort of learned in your previous iterations having built some of these businesses so far?
I mean, lots of tactical lessons. I think the most important one, it's like, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self? And it's one, it's gonna work out. So I think this long-term view of, hey, if you keep at it, you keep shipping, you keep learning, you will be successful over a long enough time frame. And then how do you do it with less of the stress? I think that was the biggest thing. Is like kind of the, I mean, you know, running a business, there's this like constant stress that happens at whatever scale. It's like, hey, I need to pay rent this month, or I need to pay my employees this month. And now we need to grow and provide a return. Like all these things just add up, both the little things and the small things. So I think that that time period, especially in that first 3 years when things were not working out, were super stressful and I was really hard on myself. So I think it's just, I mean, I'm still really hard on myself, but it's getting better, right? So I think it's just, hey, this is going to be hard. You're choosing to do something that is by nature difficult, but just keep that long-term optimism, which I always had, but that short-term, hey, try and enjoy the process more. So I think just generally for anyone that's starting off on this journey, I have dozens of things that I forget about that we ship. So it was months of energy, super excited about it. I don't even know what it is. I can't even tell you what it was. There's like all these projects I find in my like old notes that I was like, oh, wow, I did that. That was a dumb idea. Some was really good too. I was like, damn, I should have done that idea. That was like a really great idea. But I think it's just the mindset of, hey, this is a long-term game that you're trying to learn and each level is different. So I think just being able to abstract a bit and not take it so seriously in a way while still working really hard. So I think that's the core. If you're going to do this, just be fully aware of the what you're signing up for and try and enjoy the process a bit more. So I think that's the more mindset that I think is super important. And that's the advice I'd give myself back in the day.
Yeah, I appreciate that. There's kind of infamously, even though it's sort of infamous, I think every founder needs to find their own path to it, need to both be continually and stubbornly optimistic that we'll find a way and it will eventually work out and that we can overcome the challenges, but also clarity about the challenges are real and they will kill you if you don't do something about them, right?
Yeah, it's like long-term optimistic, short-term pessimistic.
Clicking into one of those kind of specific stories, I appreciated that you wrote a bit about Holopod, which is the remote work startup that you kind of touched on. Often when people have something that isn't maybe like an on-brand mega hit, it can be hard for us to kind of be like, call attention to it. And you went and did the work of helping other founders and people, you know, think about their own situations by writing about it. And something that I found kind of interesting in that story that you wrote is that you had 15% month-on-month growth in that business, which if you've never founded a funded startup, then you'd be like, okay, I guess it sounds like you succeeded then, like 50% month-on-month growth, like that would compound like really large eventually. Tell us a little bit about you know, any sort of like tactical or reflections that you had kind of from that path and you know, trying to build that business, which obviously, you know, is going to contrast to the you know, really successful ones.
Yeah, that's an interesting case study. I mean, I wrote that right when it was failing. And then I was like, I'm not going to publish this. Then, I mean, it's kind of a cop-out. I waited till I was like, quote unquote, successful again. Then I published it. But at least the data is there.
I've been guilty of doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Three years ago, here's how I failed. And now this is why I've now overcome that.
So I didn't have the guts to actually publish it at the time. But it was close. But yeah, that was an interesting business, right? So that was a side project, basically in this like remote work productivity space. So The thesis was, it's super annoying to work fully remote, especially with these like bombardment of notifications that happens all the time. Like, still an unsolved problem, but it's like Slack, Google Calendar. And then, so basically, how do you solve that issue of, hey, I want to collaborate more closely with my team, but I don't want to be constantly online and like bombarded with notifications. So basically, pretty great app. So it automated your Slack status based on your current work state. So we detect whether you're in a meeting, out for lunch, available to co-work on your calendar, or actually based on like your desktop. So if you're in your terminal, then we detect that, or you're like, you're in Figma, like, hey, I'm heads down right now. Leave me alone. So super cool app. I was trying to think the actual timeline, but it was live during Visual CV. So a side project I was working on with my friend. And then post exit of Visual CV, I was still like, hey, I don't really know what to do. So I jumped right into that project because it had decent traction. And then COVID hit and it really blew up. So just like people were looking for, one, solving this specific problem. They're looking for apps that like make their offices more productive. So yeah, crazy breakout like momentum. So yeah, you're like, I'm looking at the dashboard. I'm like, I don't know, Uber is signing up, like public companies. What else? There's Zapier. So really cool companies that are using the product, but just never hit that like we had like some virality within Teams. Actually, decent. Like it was year one of revenue. I think we probably hit like, I don't know, 80 or 90K. So like pretty decent.
Year one.
Yeah, year one. And then I think the challenge there was both like my co-founder had to go get a job because it wasn't generating revenue. I'd self-funded it. So I put a significant bit of cash into the business. I was trying to like hire people to work on it. So just never really hit our stride on team, I think, number one. It was like, I'm trying to figure out how to grow the team while growing the business. I think the other core part of that was just wasn't a business I cared that much about. Like, I'm not really like a productivity nerd. Like, I'm probably like the least structured person. So like, is this actually the app that, it was solved. We liked using it. So like people really liked the product. But just like, is this the thing I want to spend a decade on? Especially for my next thing, right? I had some cash, I had some runway, like I had time to figure it out. And I just didn't want to just jump right into something that I wasn't totally, I'm not even passionate about, but just like, is this the long-term space I want to spend all my time obsessing about? I just wasn't getting there. And then on the business side too, it wasn't like breakout growth. Like we didn't have like true product market fit with a category that we knew how to scale. And I think a lot of things went wrong there. So it's like you're an app within Slack is your primary use case. So it's kind of a passive app in the background. Like you're anchored to something that doesn't monetize already. So now you're like a paid app on top of a freemium app. In terms of raising money too, we actually went through the cycle of raising capital. Like I don't know how many investor calls we did, but a lot. And I think we closed like 250K commitment on like 100 investor calls or something. So like terrible outcome there. One lesson there just from the VC standpoint was like that category was already funded. So there was already like $1 billion or more of capital deployed against this like virtual office thesis, no clear winners. So we're falling up against that just from like how is your business categorized from a fundraising standpoint. So that was a no on fundraising, like no real breakout traction, some struggles with team. And then do I really want to do this is the core question. Or do I want to spend more time figuring out what the thing I actually want to do is, and is there more upside there? So yeah, I made the decision to shut down or sell. We found a great buyer for the business. So sideways deal. I mean, we actually got a decent amount of cash out and then just rolled that into like the new co, which has been much better.
So I'm curious to kind of follow up on that idea, which I think comes up often when leaders, founders or other leaders are thinking about, okay, what's next for me? And obviously you know, if you're at the point in your career where you have a lot of options, that's great, but also can be, you know, really challenging when you're like, okay, there's all these different opportunities. And if you've sort of built a skill of kind of seeing them, you'll end up often kind of assessing and weighing businesses or problem spaces that might really personally excite you, that you're like, oh, I'm the person, like you're saying to this, like, oh, productivity, maybe I am a big productivity nerd, or maybe I'm really into golf or whatever the thing is that for an individual that they're super excited about and that they have this kind of urge to solve. But then there's also this set of problems where it's like the economics are pulling you, where it's like there is a real reason, there's a market need and I'm well suited. I really understand the need. well because of my previous experience, or I have good connections and relationships in that space, or I just structurally see it's like an opportunity that's really just happening right now. And a couple episodes ago, we had Ian Crosby on the show who defended Bench, and he made a case for really indexing on the second, like going first, like really only considering situations where there's a really strong economic driver of a business, and then basically like finding the fun in that rather yeah. than being like, okay, well, you know, obviously you can go to the extreme and do the futile thing where like, oh, but I just would really love to make Finely Crafted Knitwork or whatever, and I'm going to try and make a VC-funded business out of it. And it's like, well, that just isn't a thing, right? How do you think about that as someone who has been, you know, you just expressed like the pain that it can sort of generate when you are looking at, oh, is this a 10-year commitment to an idea that maybe I'm not super deeply personally invested in? How do you think about the relative importance of those two pieces?
I think it's this idea of founder market fit is really, really important, especially at that early stage. So founder market fit is not product market fit, but are you the right person to solve this particular problem? And how do you define that is variable, right? So I think there's this kind of this like massive Venn diagram of like, do I care about this problem? Is it economically feasible? Is there a big market? Is it fundable? And all of those things kind of need to be true in order to be really successful. But it's kind of like the missionary versus mercenary framework too. Like, hey, if you're a missionary, you deeply believe in this vision and you don't care if it really works or not, but you're willing to like sacrifice everything to solve this problem. Or you're a mercenary, which is, hey, like I've identified this economic opportunity. There's this big gap in, I don't know, data analytics for enterprise software, and we're going to go rebuild Datadog or something. And there's no wrong answer. I think it's like, are you good at that? Can you scale that? Do you have the skills to do that is an important question. And then on the, like how I looked at it, I just really care about this problem. And it is a big market, luckily enough. It's kind of like an infinite TAM market. I don't think I would enjoy building, like I don't have experience building like kind of enterprise-y software, more boring software. So I think it's just like I picked the problem that I cared most about, and I found a way to like reverse engineer the economics so they made sense. And you pivot a lot too. Like the ideas evolve, but the core thesis has always been there. And I think it really decides what you're trying to optimize for. Like there's lots of ways to win. I think there's, especially, I mean, business generally, but in venture, there's no clear formula for success, right? You don't know what your breakout hits are going to be. You don't know how markets are going to shift. Typically, it's the stuff that looks really like weird or like off thesis initially, like Airbnb, that ends up being like the biggest not typically, but often. Or you look at, hey, like there's like some formula for building enterprise. We built like PeopleSoft, and then we go win and built Workday because it was slightly better software with a different sales motion. And then let's do it again, right? Like just for me personally, I can't imagine another business that I would want to build. Like my eyes kind of glaze over when I look at most software, and I'm just really excited. Like I love our customers. Like I think they're just super entrepreneurial and fun to talk to. There's so many problems within this space. So more it's just like a fun problem space to be in, and like the world's moving so quickly. But I think there's more risk to that too, right? So like we're picking a hard business. It's like a prosumer or close to consumer business. Like there's economics around churn that are challenging versus saying, hey, here's a problem, here's a vertical, here's a go-to-market. We can build it. There's no product risk and we're just going to get after it. That's a great strategy too. Like they're all good. There's multiple ways to win. I think it just depends on what you're trying to optimize for. And I think too, having that like margin of safety financially and some runway allowed me to just like, hey, like, I want to take the biggest swing possible for the biggest possible market outcome business and see if I can play at that level. But yeah, multiple ways to look at that.
There's something in what you're saying that I like though, which is, obviously you can't reduce like, okay, what should I do next with the next 10 years of my career into like a single sentence aphorism. And certainly the approach that Ian sort of advocates, which is like, find the most profitable thing that you could, the most business value you could possibly return. And then like, then use that as rocket fuel to the moon, which is not his wording, but like, that's kind of like the way he thinks about it. But you sort of articulated a neighboring potential strategy, potential playbook, which is find a problem that you care a lot about and that you find very motivating, and then kind of find articulation of that problem that has a very large market size.
Yeah, and also, like, what do you have an unfair advantage in, right? So I think with, I mean, Ian in particular has, like, he's the right person to build that business because he's got that, I mean, like a 0.001% of people have the experience he has in that space. So, like, intuitively, you understand that, you can go after it, you know how to scale it. But if someone else went and said, hey, like, accounting super profitable or bookkeeping, and we can automate it now, like, 90 people are going to have that, like, 1,000 people. It's kind of like an obvious idea, but then it's an execution mm-hmm. problem. And can they execute? Do they have the relationships? Do they understand the nuances of, like, all that needs to be true. So I think it really depends on this, again, this convergence of your skills, experience, and your learnings. And if you're a 19-year-old who just graduated, like, I don't know, second year university or whatever, like, are you going to build that business? Probably not, right? Like, you're probably going to build something that's, like, got higher, like higher variability. It probably won't work your first few, but, like, it might actually be huge, and you end up building some, I don't know, some crazy crypto gaming thing that's, like, way bigger than anything that I'll ever build. Like, I don't get that stuff, right? But I do think the passion piece too. Like, I'm not a, like, it's not blind, right? Like, you have to objectively mm-hmm. look at every day of your business and whether this idea is still worth it. Like, you see people that spend a decade on something that's not working, right? And that's not fun either, right? Like, it's certainly not like an enjoyable place to be. And I think that, like, it's more, can you pivot within the problem space enough to see the success that you're aiming for, or at least, like, have a good shot at it? But yeah, I think all this stuff is complex, right? You can also just go, hey, I'm going to go copy, like, a bunch of Series A funded startups and just get a few customers. Because I know, like, do it cheaper with AI or whatever. Like, there's lots of things. It's more, what are you personally trying to solve for? Are you trying to solve for money? Are you trying to solve for freedom? Are you trying to solve for impact? Are you trying to solve for ego? Like, I think just that self-reflection beforehand is important. Because a lot of people don't do it, right? You end up on this path that you're just like, oh, I don't actually like doing this. And it's, like, challenging, and I signed up for this, and this seems odd.
Well, and that's why I framed the whole question as something that people in the middle of their career or later in their career often actually learn to think about, because they end up, like, 8 years into trying to wait to IPO for some company that they have enough shares in that it's a huge, you know, difference about whether or not they leave, you know, and then it's kind of like, next time I'm going to think a bit about whether or not I care about the pet food industry or not before I attach myself to a long-term train.
And also, like money, traction, growth solves a lot of that. Like, you can kind of pretend to care about pet food if you're growing 100% month over month and you're, like, getting paid a bunch, your stock option. Like, it's like you can win in different way. You get passionate about creative brand, ad optimization, like Liquid Death is a water company that just is amazing marketing and branding. And that's, like, probably really fun to be in that business. But they're slanging, like, tap water, right? Like, it's not, so you can break down, like, you can be very passionate about a certain part of your business too. And I think that's, again, like, there's multiple ways to do this. Like, it's not, there's not that many things that, like humans need that are totally innovative and crazy, right? You find, like, a different way to innovate on a problem and, like, enjoy the output, right? So with Durable, like, I enjoy obviously the customers, the products, but, like, hey, can we create really great education? Can we create really good marketing videos? Can we try stuff that's, like, more fun? Like, so it's like, parts of your job can still be really fun, even if, like, the core kind of overarching mission isn't that exciting to you too.
Well, there's something fundamentally fun about, like, growing, or at least to me, maybe this, like, it was my bias, but I find there's something fundamental fun about growing a team, growing a business, solving problems. It's almost like, in some ways, like a video game when it's working well, where it's like, and now you've get to the next level and, like, you have better stats, but also the enemies are harder now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, now scaling is a problem, and, like, oh, now you have, you know, now you have to learn how to hire a, like, a VP instead of just knowing how to hire, like, a line manager, and, like, what does that mean and how do you do that well?
Yeah.
So that's, like, once you're moving, it's fun. I think often where a lot of companies really struggle is if they end up on a path where they don't yet have the growth that's making it compelling, and they haven't really gotten also what's driving that founder or that early team to push through to doing the really hard thing to getting from the zero to one. Like, once you're at one plus, then that's more fun.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to build the diagram, it's probably business you don't care that much about, but growth, like, okay, it's not bad. Or it's business you really care about, no growth, like, that kind of sucks, but you might figure it out. And then it's like business you really care about plus growth is like the ultimate. But you also have to earn the right to that too, right? So like Visual CV, like I've never had a job and it was a resume building platform. So not a business that had a lot of founder market fit. I enjoyed the process of building a nice product for millions of people that generated lots of revenue. And it enabled me to, like, I was trying to solve for like financial freedom with that business. Like that was my goal as like a 21-year-old or whatever. It was, hey, I want to be able to travel. So I lived in Argentina for 6 months. We had a small team. I had lots of freedom and time. And that was the goal. And I did that. It was actually bigger than I thought it would be, which is awesome. So yeah, that was like growth, but product I wasn't super passionate about, but you got passionate about SEO, about paid marketing, about customer, like, so building the business part of it. And then I think for Durable, it kind of takes the fun of the business building, but also the fun of the product that I really care about. So just fortunate to do that. And that's just like, you never know what's going to work too. Right. And I think you want to earn your right to like the passion project too, to some degree. So I think it's like, yeah, maybe lead with economic value first if you're trying to solve for that. And then like, again, the crazy ideas can come later, but everyone's different too, right? And like you can never really reverse engineer these things, especially if the ones that get really big.
But it's my job to at least try.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So let's shift gears from I probably did it backwards, but let's shift gears from the big picture, like philosophy of founding a company stuff to some of the tactics and like actually what goes into some of this stuff. And I know you've spent some time, you know, talking to and advising some startups and seeing not just the paths of your businesses, but some others. Are there any things that you've sort of seen either in some of the combination of experiences that you've seen that are, you know, tactics or approaches that don't necessarily come naturally to teams, founders, leaders that you find yourself sort of advocating for people to put more attention into or to get more serious about that that have kind of come out of what you've seen?
Yeah, I think a lot of people end up doing a lot of like fake work when they first start a project. And it's almost just like they want this academic exercise of starting a business. So it's the, hey, what's the right answer to that? I'm probably what we're doing now, right? What's the right answer here? Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of, especially for type A people that are really successful in like in school and work. It's like, hey, there needs to be a right answer here. What should I do? I just want to do that. So you end up like, oh, I should, I don't know, optimize my ads, optimize my website. I should like, I don't know, make sure companies form. So you have a lot of this like extraneous work. But what really matters is like, are you building an amazing product and do you have customers that really like it? So just like getting down to that specific problem is actually surprising how easy it is to forget when there's all this other stuff going on, because it's all new and you're trying to figure all this out. So it's like the majoring in minor things, like I'm running some non-materially amount of paid ads to my landing page to try to optimize my conversion rate. It's like, God, like you have no data. Like you can't get data from that, right? You're just trying to like smoke test it to prove to yourself it's a good idea. So I think it's that, like that truly go manually recruit your first batch of customers, work really, really closely with them, and be in constant communication with them to solve a real problem. And talk to them as much as you possibly can, and build something really great too. I think the bar for products is a lot higher than it used to be. Depends on the market, but you can't launch like MVPs anymore. They have to be like fully baked.
Or at least the V has gotten more strict, right? You still want to launch a minimum viable product, but what's viable is now way higher.
Yeah, I call it a minimum valuable product. So is this actually useful for somebody? Like, so that's one, is just like, hey, are you actually focusing on the right things? And have you scheduled your time and your data to understand what those are? And typically it's just write code, talk to users. I think YC's got good advice there. But I would also say spending more time on the, like, is this a good business before you actually write any code? So that zero to one, or that negative one to zero stage. So one of my first investor, South Park Commons, they have a program called the Founder Fellowship that, I mean, they write you a $500K check. They say, hey, spend as much time as you want to figure out what the actual business is. So spending more time in that customer validation, It's talking to people. It's like coming up with ideas. It's testing them. It's launching them. So just take that period, like spend more time in that period and try and prove stuff out faster. I mean, don't get totally married to your idea. I think that's the most, like, it's truly the most important phase of a new startup is what are you actually going to do? And is there market demand for this? So I think with that program, like I think it was 15 people in that cohort, but just seeing like the iteration there, right? Like there's like what we thought were great ideas a month later, like, hey, no one actually cared about this. And we talked to, I don't know, 50 customers. We actually built something, we tested. So getting really good at like rapidly iterating on ideas, then actually being able to just kill them. Mm-hmm. So we saw teams that had ideas that seemed great, didn't really work. Then they had another idea. And then like 2 years later, they've raised like $50 million and they're growing really. It's just like, it's so interesting how the right thing at the right time just grows so much quicker than the non-right thing at the right time. So more time like developing that muscle of what's actually a good idea and what's going to grow and how those like product, market, customers, is there tailwinds to the market? Like getting good at that exercise, I think, is infinitely valuable. And that's also some of the harder thing to do because it doesn't feel productive sometimes too, right? You're like, hey, I should be like building something, but if it's the wrong thing, you can spend a lot of time in that like kind of going down the wrong path.
Yeah. And it's also one of the challenges. I've been through that a bunch, you know, running for many years, a services business where we were building products for clients, but then also building our own experimental products. Like, oh, maybe this is can be its own business. Maybe this can be its own business. And it can be difficult for the morale of the team if you're like the founder who's like, kill it. Okay, yeah, okay, no, but this is really good. Let's build this really well and really fast. Oh, kill it. And you're doing that like over and over again, yeah, let alone your own morale. But that's part of the secret, I guess, is to be able to keep doing that.
Yeah. And everything that you do, I think it's the realization that if you choose to do it, it's going to take like 5 times longer, be 100 times harder than you think it is from that early stage. It's like, oh, this is a great idea. We've got like 4 people really like it. And then like a year later, like, holy shit, like that was a lot of work. And now 7 people like it. Like,
yeah,
like it's just that like... It's just harder, right? And I think the overhead, like you have to learn how to, again, your go-to-market, your marketing, your brand, like all those things have to come together. And I think in that stage too, it's like having a small team, if not just the co-founders, is the right size for that 0 to 1, we're trying to figure out what to do phase, or -1 to 0.
Partly because it's so much easier to turn the ship when the ship is delivered to the two of you and are both fully bought in. And then like you and your co-founder, maybe there's like 3 or 4 of you, it's way easier to be in a room and be like, all right, this isn't working. Okay, let's get excited about the next thing. Then it's like, okay, well, how are we going to break it to our 9th hire or a 15th person or whatever, who their entire career was in this market, which we've now decided that we're not going to be in.
Exactly, right? Super tough.
So on the, pulling on the thread of timing and the right times for things can make such a huge difference. I want to ask a little bit about what you've been learning building on LLMs. You mentioned that you'd started kind of very early on, which obviously the capabilities from GPT-3 to 3.5 to 4, and now supposedly 5 is coming before the end of the year, is changing the underlying capabilities and the market and the relative competition and the ability to build things at such a pace that it's really fascinating to me, and that's something that I've been talking to a lot of people about recently. And I'd be curious to learn from you, what are some of the things that you've seen building tools so durable, obviously, maybe not obviously for folks who haven't seen the product yet, but started as this website builder tool where LLMs could sort of create something that, building something where you sort of generate a website that's like actually coherent and relevant to the person who's trying to get this business started 2 years ago is not like a thing that you could just build. And then now it is a thing that you can build. But what have you been kind of learning as now one of the teams, which there isn't that many yet, that have, kind of scale, like you've had millions of websites created using these tools. What have you been learning about that transition from like, it's maybe easy to make a demo, harder to scale a product built on these LLMs? And kind of what are the sort of early lessons learned in really harnessing these tools?
When we first launched our, the goal, we had a website product before that we were, again, toying around with LLMs, like early or mid 2022, it was a busy year last year. And then, yeah, the timelines always get blurred in startups. And we had a website problem. Like, hey, what we learned from our customers, like, hey, no one can actually, like, as simple as our product was, they can't, like, complete their website. Like, they don't have the time. Mm. They can't figure it out. So then we thought, hey, how can AI build your website for you? So can LLMs now select your colors, choose the template, write the copy, just like make something a lot faster than what the customer would do. So we're like, yeah, let's build that and see if it goes. And this was October 2022. So like OpenAI was still in beta. We built this product. We shared it with a few people. And like instantly, there's like, holy shit. Like there was like that real visceral moment we saw in person from people. Like we went to people in coffee shop, showed them on their phone. And they're like, their eyes light up. They're like, oh, John, come over, look at this. I think it was just like, okay, we might have something here. We launched it. I think we had 1,000 sites built our first day. I'm like, okay, there's something here. And then all of a sudden we have 10,000 sites, then 100,000 sites. And then about a month and a half later, and one, we hit our beta quotas very quickly. So we're like begging like Sam Altman to like up our limits. So we're like, oh shit, we're ready for this much growth. And then ChatGPT launched about a month and a half later. And that's when the world just totally switched to like AI is everything, AI first. And we basically like got on the wave right before it broke, right? So like we were able to ride that tailwind and then business has just grown exponentially since then. So like very good timing. I think on the product specific side, I look at AI as this like massive enabler of workflow. So previous and current versions of software, the customer, the user still has to do the work, right? You have a spreadsheet, you got to enter the data. You have a website, you have to like choose the pictures. But with AI, you now have like a human like enabled intelligence, hopefully more than a human at some point, that's like the best web designer in the world, right? That now works for you 24/7. So they're optimizing your website, they're optimizing your SEO, they're helping you pick design patterns. And then you take that concept and bring it to marketing. Okay, now you've got an amazing marketer that works for you. You've got an amazing bookkeeper, accountant. So how do you just bring this human level or better intelligence to an individual who could not afford those people and give them leverage? So as a solo business, now you have the power of 10 employees working for you 24/7 to optimize your business. That's really where we want to go to. We're certainly not there in the path yet. We're building some stuff that's getting reasonably close to like the basics of those workflows. But that's how we think about it is, hey, we've got this super powerful system that like to some degree negates the purpose of a UI, right? Like if our customers should, like if they don't want to, they should never have to log into the product. They should get a text message once a day that's like, hey, you've got 4 jobs booked tomorrow. We sent 4 invoices for you and your site got 20 leads in the last week. Like that's a super cool user experience, right? That's like, hey, you never have to do anything besides show up and do the work and get paid for it. So that's really where we want to go with the product. And I think it's been certainly a wild time to build on a technology that's evolving so quickly, right? So I think it's the like, oh, is GPT-4 gonna kill like a bunch of businesses? Is GPT-5 gonna sell? Like when video comes out, like, okay, all these AI video companies are gonna have a hard time. But I think with us in terms of differentiation and longevity and durability, it's this, hey, we know who our customers are. We know there's like billions of them. And we're not trying to build base level models right now. We're not competing with OpenAI. We're not competing on the core frameworks. We're trying to apply these models, optimize them, build really specific workflows for a customer base in the most effective way possible. So really, how we become a reasonably deep technology companies, we need to do that. But also how do we apply frontier technology to real people in the most effective way possible? And again, like a broad enough problem space to work with, I think is really important and a big vision.
Yeah. And like you've, as we talked about a bit, like you've set yourself, I think, up in like what seems like in a really good way in terms of like, okay, you have this problem space, this obviously, I say obviously, you had to actually make the case, but like obviously a potentially $1 billion business, you're addressing something that's like sort of vaguely, if you squint at it, Shopify sized in what you're trying to do. And in some ways, like there's there's that perfect fit in between, like, okay, you're trying to solve a problem that's really big, and there's a whole bunch of different ways you could tackle it, so let's all go, you know, attack this problem. So the business side of it makes sense. From that actual, like, implementation side of, as you've been building so far, have there been any kind of, like, surprises or things around the actual, like, you know, nuts and bolts of, like, building on this stuff that have kind of changed your way of thinking about some of these tools in their current state? Or is it still kind of just like, ah, there's so many problems at hand and there's so much new stuff happening that you're just sort of just in the process of harnessing it, rather than like, oh, we thought that this, but it turned out that, like, that path is kind of a bit of a dead end for now, and we've been more prioritizing building things with, you know, this way in terms of, like, either you know, workflows or things like that?
Yeah, I think tactically the tooling is still very new. So, like, with cloud, there's, like, I don't know, there's multiple products. Like, it's like there's been, I don't know, 10 or 15, probably 20 years of R&D there. The costs have gone down. So I think with like LLMs, you're still building off of, like, brand new tooling, right? So, like, we had to build our own like hosting, analytics, latency is a big issue. So kind of the same scaling issues you see with every technology, LLMs have the same thing. So, like, understanding what queries fail, why do they take so long? Like, is Azure better than OpenAI for hosting, like, those models? Do we experiment with open source? We've got this framework now where we can really quickly test different models, like, fall back to, like, so building the infra, I think, was, like, harder than not harder than you expect, but quite challenging to build proper infra at our scale. So just from, like, a product standpoint there. And then how do we apply this stuff as it changes really quickly, right? So, like, OpenAI is launching a video model. Like, can we leverage that to, like, create amazing video for our customers? Or voice is really exciting. So can you automatically answer the phone for everybody and schedule their jobs for them? And, like, can we build that? Is the tech ready too, right? Because a lot of this stuff, it feels really great in a demo. And then when it comes to brass tacks, like, yeah, it's not quite there. There's some latency, or the you can't build the proper workflows yet. So it's really this iteration towards, is this ready for production? And can we win the market in our category for that specific product category is one way we look at it. And then on the customer learning side, what's been surprising is how much they trust the AI already, and trust in a way that they, like, they just want the problem solved for them. Like, they're like, oh, this copy is really good. I don't know if I could write better copy, right? Or, like, some iterations of that, or this web design's really good. So it's really not a question of how do we get more people to use our products. It's how do we solve the core problem in a much faster, better way. So with websites, it's not, hey, we got to make our website editor easier. It's like, no, the website output has to be better. We have to be optimizing that site. We have to be, like, getting kind of the preferences from the customer in a different way. So maybe that's a phone call, a conversation, like a survey, but just, like, take that data and apply it, as opposed to, again, like, expecting the user to go and do the work. So that's been surprising, how much they just want to be solved for them, and how much they actually, like, not trust is the wrong word, it's just like believe in the technology being able to solve that already, I think is really interesting. And there's a ton of opportunity there.
Do you think of, and this is, like, just sort of a broad, you know, product development question for those of us that are, like, building and exploring what can be built with these tools. Do you think of the chat interface as, like, kind of the default go-to, like, okay, we're going to evolve these products and what they can do? And, like, obviously, if you're, you know, you're generating a website and then you're going to want to refine the website, does your mind and your exploration so far kind of lean towards, well, we're going to have people refine that website by talking to a chat bot, where you're like, oh, can you zhuzh it up, or can you make it sound more corporate, or can you talk more about my free trial, or whatever the things are that you, or you, do you, are you finding, at least with the level of the tool so far, that more kind of bespoke UX workflows that have a little bit more structure to them is kind of the more powerful approach?
Yeah, still TBD. I'm not long-term bullish on chat as the core UX for a lot of this stuff, primarily because chat, like, for chat to work, you need to know what to ask. And for a lot of our customers, this is not their core expertise, right? Like, they don't know what SEO is, really. So they're not going to ask, like, hey, how do I optimize my SEO? So I think we need to set the bar higher for being the expert here. So the way we break it down is, like reactive and proactive. So reactive workflows would be, hey, something's not working, or I want to do this. So they're actually asking the question, and that's kind of a chat or like a question response. Like, hey, I want to add a new page. Okay, sweet. What's the page? Sweet, it's added. But proactive would be, hey, we've identified that you don't have individual pages for your services. If you want to optimize for SEO in Vancouver for plumbing, you should have like individual pages. We've already built these pages. We've already optimized them. Do you want to press go? And that's like a yes, no answer. I think that's a mind-blowingly cool experience for someone is like, hey, wow, this is actually like, I wouldn't have thought of that. It's like smarter than me at SEO, obviously. And it's just like this kind of this nexus of things. So like if you imagine, well, let's talk about website just because it's obviously our core product right now, but there's 10 things that every amazing website has. We feed the model those 10 things, and then we need to figure out how to get the data to do those 10 things for the customer. And it's
right.
Not necessarily, I think it's not necessarily a chat. It's like we send them a text message at the right time asking for photos. Realize they don't have a logo, so we send them 12 logo options and they can pick the right one. So it's just more like, and then what order of those things too, right? Can the LLM actually figure out like, okay, like people, like if they, like photos more, like it's easier to get photos than it is to get a logo. So we ask for the photos first and really excited about that. So it's like, how precise do you have to model out and schedule these workflows? So like there's ways of doing that are very like kind of traditional, if this, like, if no photos, then send text for photos. The way we're trying to design that is like more, hey, AI web designer, here's the things that we need to get from our customers in a way that doesn't annoy them in the most effective way possible. Can you figure it out? Which is a different and a much harder problem, but like it's pretty cool, right? You're learning like what language works, and like you're like the end goal for, I mean, websites again is this like idea of like what is the perfect website and how do we iterate towards that on a like every data point that we have, right? So that's both like output, it's customer input, it's customer feedback, it's like it's conversion optimization. So like can you build a model that's self-perpetuating there and then like start feeding that model in a way that's really effective? That's like that's hard, right? It's not
sure.
It's not the way that's actually going to drive like the most customer value immediately, but that's like the long-term R&D that I think if you can apply that concept to like every product within our platform, then it just gets better and better over time and it's self-perpetuating. And then as these models get smarter, those problems get easier to solve, right? So like GPT-4 is, it's okay at analyzing websites and providing feedback. Like it's probably like a 12-year-old designing websites. They're like, this is cool. But GPT-5.
But like, you know, a 12-year-old that's read a lot of books.
Exactly. But GPT-5 might be amazing, right? Like it might just be, oh, wow, it's actually providing like amazing feedback on conversion optimization. And we can take that and like optimize our sites with that. So I think it's just being ready for the next spikes and how stuff is going to evolve. So like, I think that's one way we're looking at it. Okay, yeah, it's going to be like, okay right now, but the next model is going to be like, oh, wow, this workflow that we thought was not solvable or not that great is like, wow, this is done. Like we've figured out how to automatically optimize like marketing campaigns for plumbers in Idaho now. Like you can't do that right now with GPT-4, but maybe 5 solves that when the agent model is more effective and it's smart enough to know like, hey, you should go post on Craigslist and Nextdoor and Thumbtack. So all this stuff just, I think it gets really cool and it's going to get even cooler very quickly.
It's interesting that you frame it that way, where my mind goes, not having immersed myself into this business the way that you have, is that, well, I need to become a world expert in how to optimize this Craigslist ads for a plumber in Idaho so that I can build some sort of like hybrid prompting, like RAG, as they call it, like prepping the agent so that it has the context so that it understands that. And then also some UI that coaxes and encourages the customers that like, hey, it's worth actually doing this, like help them. Obviously the plumber is not going to become a world expert in this, but like help them understand like, hey, if you get a sense of how you differentiate yourself from the other plumbers, that will help you a lot. So like, keep an eye on that, and then we'll do this other piece. Whereas your mind is, at least sounds like, less focused on, like, how do we do the customer education? And, like, maybe it's a little bit, just because it's a bit of a boil the ocean problem, because how to make the best Craigslist ad for a plumber in Ohio is totally different than how to make the best, slogan front page hero photo for a home chef in Vancouver. So I don't know. I find that interesting.
Yeah, I think the core, and I think it's a, specifically with our customer base, right? It's like, if you are good at that, like, job, right? We're constantly building a profile of, like, hey, how can we just, like, so again, you're the plumber in Idaho, like, how do you, like, think about differentiation? Do you have really good Google reviews? Are we pulling data from the Google reviews? Like, oh, they're always reliable. They're always on time. They're really friendly. They do a great job. They're really good at, like, a specific thing. So you're building this, like, kind of understanding of your customer that allows you to customize more and more as it goes. So you're basically building this, like, model again. And I think, like, the metaphor that's helpful for us is, like, if this person was to hire for these functions within their business, what would they want to know, right? You'd want to know, like, obviously, like, what you're good at, what your differentiation is. But the thing with, like, services specifically, like, it's kind of like, are you good at this and do you show up? It's not like e-commerce where there's a ton of complexity around inventory, supply chain. So it is a business where if there is market demand and you can deliver that skill, we can help you with the rest of those things. And it kind of just, and the bar is pretty low, not for service quality, but for, like, for marketing, for follow-up, for answering your phone. Like, AI can do that a lot better than these people who are super strapped and, like, going between jobs trying to answer text messages. Like, it's a really great solution for this category of business, primarily because they don't have the resources to hire the individuals and they don't have the time to figure out the tooling. So this is where AI, I think, really shines, is can we be better than our customers at those specific functions so they can focus on what they're really great at? And then over time, we build, like, data sets and profiles that, again, like, hey, we learn more about how you want to communicate with your customers. So, like, your voice and tone, or your style, or, like, and then that applies to the entire platform, right? So your ads look a little different. Your copy looks a little different. Your emails look a little different. Your text messages look a little different. And just, like, gets way more personal over time. I think that's where it gets, like, yeah, very exciting and very, like, kind of self-fulfilling in a way that's, like, going to be pretty sweet.
Well, I love the idea of a world where all the various plumbers and service providers that I engage with over the course of the year have an assistant that actually answers when it's like, are you on your way? Or
100%.
Are we on for this? Or how much is this going to cost? And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing how this builds out. Thanks so much for coming on the show, James. Where can people go to find more about you and the work that you're doing?
Twitter, probably, at James Clift. Unfortunately, my most active platform.
All right. So we'll link that up, and of course, Durable as well, in the show notes. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. Until next time, keep shipping.